Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, February 27th, 2010. I'm Harley Schlanger and I'm your host today. We spend a lot of time on this program reporting on the corruption and outright idiocy of our nation's leaders and why they, starting with President Obama, must be removed from office immediately. But today we're going to look at this problem from a deeper level. Where does this corruption and idiocy come from? Does it stem from an inherent flaw in the nature of man, as many profess to believe? Or is there another explanation? That most of the world's population has been deliberately inculcated with a belief system about the nature of man and the universe, which causes us to become corrupt idiots by shaping the way we think and therefore what we believe. On today's program, we're going to take on one of the biggest causes of this idiocy, the propagation of something called the second law of thermodynamics. I'm joined by two of my colleagues from LaRouche PAC, Phil Rubenstein and Bruce Director. And I assure you that if you pay close attention to our discussion today, you'll not only come to an understanding of the methodological basis for our problems, but maybe you'll be moved to do something about it. So Phil and Bruce, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Yeah, hello.
Now, I'd like to start with you, Bruce, because as we were talking before, Lynn has just written a very new paper, but his paper last week on It's a Republic, Not a Democracy, he had some very provocative things to say about the question of the nature of the universe, that the universe itself is creative. Why don't we start with that? What is Lynn getting at with this?
Well, what Lynn is discussing in actually a probably the most advanced way it's ever been discussed in history, is something that really was understood by all great scientists and thinkers and artists who made a significant contribution to the advancement of human knowledge all throughout history, which is that there is a single universe, not multi-universes and multiple parts of the universe, and this universe is characterized by a tendency to create higher states of organization and existence. And we refer to this characteristic in the human mind as being creativity, the ability of the human mind to create new ideas, new discoveries of principles of the way the universe works, as well as new discoveries about the way the human mind works, the discovery of principles of the way the universe works, physical universe works, we call science, and discoveries of principle about the way the mind works are associated with classical art. And the mind, the human mind, has this capacity which no other creature in the universe has, and the human mind does this on a purely willfully. Human beings have the willful capability to decide to discover something completely new and introduce new thoughts into the universe. Now, however, the entire universe actually is has this characteristic. And this can be seen just by looking at the universe as a whole. And we now, of course, with the advancements in scientific technology, we can actually capture this more. But when you look at astrophysical phenomena, astronomical phenomena like the formation of stars and galaxies and things like the Crab Nebula, you see that the physical universe, all throughout its parts, in the very large as well as here on Earth, is always creating. You see it in the subatomic domain as well.
Well, Bruce, let me just cut you off there, because I want to bring up the question that will be brought up by any physics student or science student or mathematician in most universities, because this idea of a tendency to create higher states of order, that's not a universally accepted idea today, is it?
Well, not today, and that's because probably in the mid-19th century, really at the initiative of two idiots primarily, a guy whose original name was William Thomson and then Rudolf Clausius, introduced what has become known as the second law of thermodynamics, which I can talk about in a little bit. But this idea has become virtually the central tenet of the official state cult religion of the British Empire.
But you're saying that before this, there were scientists, in fact, maybe even a fairly important faction of scientific thinkers, who saw the universe as creating higher order, increased potential. You're saying that was a generally accepted view.
Well, there's always been a fight in human history. And what you see when you look at the development of society and the development of science, you see that on the one side, you have those people who actually make discoveries, which actually sets the agenda for the development of mankind. People like Plato, Archytas, Leonardo da Vinci, Kuza, Leibniz, and so on and so forth. This, the source of their discoveries comes from a recognition that the universe is what today we would call anti-entropic. It's always tending towards creating new states of organization and existence. You see this in the physical universe, as I was saying, for example, with the development of new states of matter in the astrophysical and microscopic domain as well. You see it in the form in living processes, in the development of higher and more efficient species, and you see it in human beings, where you have a willful capability of the human mind, which is not, as LaRouche emphasizes, the brain or the biological process, but something that is immaterial, may be attached to the body, at least for the time of our mortal lives, but it's the human mind which is capable of also generating higher states of organization of existence. Now, I think the important thing that make to grasp in this is that there is an inseparable connection between the way people look at the physical universe and the way the nature of the universe as a whole, and the way their ideas about the organization of society. That is, throughout human history, we organize our societies based on the way we view the universe as a whole, and we develop concepts about the universe as a whole which reflect our concept of man. So throughout history, you've had, on the one hand, people who recognize, and these are the creative ones, that the universe is creative and fight to organize societies according to those principles, such as the idea of the Republic of Plato and the most advanced form of that in the Constitutional Republic of the United States. On the other side, you have the imperial system. The imperial system views man as nothing different than an animal, that the creative capacity of the human mind they take out of the human character. And therefore, they want a society organized the way you organized uncreative things.
Well, then, Bruce, what you're saying essentially is that this introduction of the second law of thermodynamics and the concept of entropy has always been an idea that was imposed by the empire.
Exactly. The idea is, in simple terms or most general terms, is the idea as to whether or not the characteristic of the universe is one that is always changing or whether it's a fixed state. And you had, for example, from the time of the Peloponnesian Wars until the Renaissance, for more than 1,500 years, the dominant form of European society was an imperial system, either the Persian or Roman imperial system, or as it later developed in the Venetian and Byzantine empires and so forth. And you had a dominant view of science associated with the Aristotelian view, which is expressed by the Ptolemaic cosmology or other forms of strange views of science. And these ideas reflected the way people, the imperial form of social order.
Well, first, let me bring Phil on this, because I'd like his thoughts on this. How is it then, if it is obvious, or if it was clear to the Pythagoreans and others, this question of expanding, of change, and so on, that how can they impose an idea like entropy, which is in a sense, an idea of death, the death of the man and the planet?
Well, I think there's two ways to look at this. One way is to realize, you can look at it from the standpoint of what Sarpi did, although I think it's the same thing you see with, let's say, Aristotle versus Plato, because the problem is to be truly self-conscious of the that creativity, this process of development and change, and becoming, as Plato called it, is a willful act and a knowable act, and is the measure of truth. It's how you know, in other words, by changing your relationship to the universe based on a concept which you've constructed because you've come to the limit of a prior system, you have the potential to realize that creativity is intelligible. It's self-reflexive. It's knowable. Now, the key, if that's true, then each human individual has the power of creative mentation, becomes a potential contribution to the development of society. Now, the oligarchy's view is that that's bad. We don't want people to value themselves that way. Therefore, what their argument is, this was an accident. It's sort of like a mutation in an evolutionary system. This just, you know, a system may not have worked, and there's an arbitrary imposition of a new hypothesis, a new axiom. That comes out of, you know, just a burp, an accident. You can never know that. All you can know is the axiomatic deductive system that comes out of this arbitrary feature.
Now, you mentioned that
most people can be impelled to think of their life in the most limited way, in the most egocentric way, they lose a contact with the universality of that process available to them of the changes that the human species makes in its relationship to nature. So what you have is a kind of confrontation between an oligarchical outlook that rejects the intelligibility and the quality of creativity available to each human being. And in a sense, they rewrite history. They say, no, it wasn't something that was knowable. It wasn't something that was intelligible. It was an accident that we can use, but we now have to submit ourselves to the new system. And most people are afraid of breaking with what the known capabilities are, the known rules are, and the oligarchy plays on that. And this has been repeated, Aristotle versus Plato, Sarpi versus Kuza, the positivists, versus the Weimar classics and the American Revolution, as Bruce said, this is a historic battle over the nature of mankind.
Well, let me take up a couple of these themes, and I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to the LaRouche Show. We're talking with Phil Rubenstein and Bruce Director. And if you do have questions that are related to this topic, I don't want you to call in and ask me what a national bank is and something of that sort today, although we may take it up. But if you have questions that get to the subject matter, please send them in. We can take them at radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. And we're talking about the nature of the universe. And, Bruce, I think one of the points you were making is that the human mind does not exist outside of this universe.
Well, that's precisely it. There's a single universe, and the universe requires the creative powers of the human mind for its development. And I think, you know, the way to look at this is if in an imperial system, the objective is to keep everybody in their place and everybody fixed. And in fact, it's ironic that this idea of globalization is precisely organized around that way. And in the imperial system, the only form of change comes by the arbitrary intervention of the will of the emperor. And everybody's supposed to know their place. And the imperial cultures organize a concept of science and man that reflects this imperial view. Typical of this is the Aristotelian or Ptolemaic idea that the earth is at the center where everything is changing, and then as you get further away from the earth towards the fixed stars, things change less and less and less, so that out there beyond the fixed stars where heaven is, obviously things don't change at all. And if we could just get things not to change, everything could be perfect. So as long as you're alive and on earth, where everything is always changing, you're as far away from perfection as you possibly can, and you have to submit to the rule of the emperor. This was the cosmology which justified the imperial system, which was like a cult religion, which everybody believed.
Well, what led to a break away from that? What was the change you mentioned up to from a Peloponnesian War till Cusa? What led to that break?
Well, the first point is that this imperial system is a false idea which was imposed on superior cultures, which broke down, which lost the moral fitness to survive and ended up submitting for one reason or another to a more inferior form of culture.
But how could a superior view of these questions end up being defeated?
Because human creativity is willful, and the human being has to voluntarily exercise the creative powers of the mind, and if one stops exercising or a culture, like you take the what happened to the how the Peloponnesian Wars came about. The Greek culture had defeated the Persian imperial system twice, had been responsible for great advances, probably the most concentrated advances in scientific knowledge and cultural knowledge that mankind had ever seen. And they were the Persian Empire, the imperial system, corrupted them from within through sophistry, through money and a financial system, got the Greeks fighting against each other. This is what Plato talks about in his dialogues. And Greek culture just disappeared, very similar to what's happening here. Here, our nation was the most advanced form of society ever constructed. We defeated the British Empire three times in military wars, four times in the Revolutionary War, in the War of 1812, in the Civil War, and again by Roosevelt in World War II. And here, with the baby boomer generation, our culture has been corrupted by the imperial system, where we end up with a lunatic like Obama as president of the United States. Now you have a reaction against that, led by LaRouche, which is seeking to get the American America back to the American system. But it's just important in my mind to stress that it's not the imperial system which drives the process of history. The imperial system is a reaction against a higher form of culture. Now, what happened is that the imperial system collapsed in the mid-15th century. It collapsed because of its own built-in problem of the empire system, and Cusa took the opportunity of the weakened imperial structure to reinitiate on a much higher level the advanced concept of man and creativity that had been earlier expressed in Greek culture. And as a result of what Cusa did, as I said, which is a much higher level, you have the European Renaissance and all the advances that came out of that. So for the last 400 years, you've had the oligarchical system trying to reintroduce into human thought ideas which are similar to Aristotle's ideas in their fundamental substance. But because Aristotle had become totally discredited, they had to come up with new tricks. And that's where the second law of thermodynamics comes in. It comes in as sort of the last trick played by the imperial oligarchy to try and undo to counter the creative advances that were made in the tradition of Cusa, Leibniz, Gauss, and Riemann in particular.
All right. Well, let's take a look at that, because that's obviously a turning point or a branching point. And I received a message via a totally inferior form of communication called a text. But someone asked if Phil would describe or offer a definition of entropy and anti-entropy, and then connect the second law of thermodynamics to those definitions.
Well, I mean, entropy. You don't want to get too trapped into these things, but you know, the basic model is a kinematic model, basically of little hard balls or gas molecules bumping around. And I'll make a point of this, and affecting one another, bouncing off of one another. Now, if you have a situation where you have a beginning state of some kind or other that you have a certain array of these independent particles of some kind or other, and certain kinds of forces acting such that these particles bump into one another, you find that over a certain amount of time, due to heat loss, thermal loss. This is why it's called thermodynamics. Thermal loss in the elasticity of the percussive actions, there's a tendency toward an increasing randomization or a spreading out, a uniformization of the energy, so-called. Now, this is a problem with the definition of energy. So that effectively the system runs down. Mm-hmm. And there's less and less work that can be done, i.e. less and less to actively rearrange the events inside of this system.
And that's what we call an entropic system.
Right.
Yeah.
That's entropy.
Yeah.
Now, anti-entropic, you can say, is not just... See, there are certain views you can have a local change or something like that, like this guy Prigogine. But in a truly anti-entropic, in other words, anti, the way, you know, LaRouche refers to anti-Euclidean as opposed to non-Euclidean. And, of course, Euclid is a perfect example of this rearrangement of history. All of geometric knowledge from the Greeks predated Euclid, and then he axiomatized it and made it systemic and therefore, in its own way, entropic. Any axiomatic system is entropic. So anti-entropy means a non-axiomatic system or a non-closed system. That is to say that within the system, something is occurring which allows you to reorganize or introduce a new form of action or a new capability of work, which is a much better definition of energy, a reorganization of the energy flow such that a greater amount of work can be done, such that you've changed the nature of the system. Now, I think one of the important things in this is that the entire second law of thermodynamics concept is rooted in the idea of closed systems. In other words, one of the assumptions they bring in, which they sneak in, is the idea, well, we're dealing with a closed system. Now, that can be either a given closed system or the idea that, well, we may not know all the rules of the closed system, but there is a closed system. There is something beyond which you cannot go, and that's defined by a certain set of axioms and formal rules of deduction. Now, the reality is, and I think you have to start from the highest level, the reason that we know the universe is developing and we know we can access the principles of development is precisely because human beings are willfully creative. That it's the fact that we can create an idea expressed in a crucial experiment which changes something in the activity in the universe, which tells us that indeed the universe is not a closed system. So it's the action of human willful creativity, which exists in this universe, and that's what's anti-entropic. Every system, the principles of a system, always are outside and above the system. Knowing those principles allows you to act on and change the system.
Go ahead,
so
Bruce.
The universe is anti-entropic. Okay.
Let me just very quickly. Just to underscore what Phil said, I think if I go very briefly through just the history of how this, even this term entropy got introduced, people will see what a total fraud it is, and they'll be quite embarrassed that they actually believe in it, even if they don't know what it's about. You had the idea, as I said, the reestablishment of this idea that Phil just mentioned, that the human mind is paradigmatic of the characteristic. The creative powers of the human mind are paradigmatic of the characteristic of the universe as a whole. Was recognized by Kuza, Leibniz, and Kepler, who demonstrated that in the astrophysical domain and also in the microphysical domain that Kuza was right. Then you have Leibniz, who extends Kepler's discoveries with his concept of the notion of dynamics. And here you have Leibniz showing in his arguments against Descartes that it's that even the abiotic parts of the universe are governed by what he called metaphysical principles, or what later became known, is he called dynamic principles, and dynamic comes from the Greek word dunamis, which means power.
Hey, Bruce, when you use the term like abiotic, can you just describe what that means?
Things so, that processes which we associate with non-living or human activity. For example, the motion of a pendulum swinging back and forth under the influence of gravity. Now, what Leibniz says is all processes must conform to the characteristic of the human mind, and therefore they must be creative, and therefore they're governed by principles or dynamic characteristics or potential, and that it's not the visible domain. It's not what you see. It's not the material aspects of the object's motion or activity which are determining what the object is doing or what the process is doing, but it's the deeper underlying what Leibniz called metaphysical principles which actually govern it, like the principle of gravitation. You don't see gravity, but gravity has very well-defined and determined harmonic characteristics as described by Kepler and the motions of the planets and so forth. You see the planets move. You see the pendulum swing. But you don't see the principle that's governing this organized motion.
So how do you discover the principle?
Well, Leibniz shows you discover the principle by recognizing what it is in the human mind how this characteristic of the human mind works, that the mind has the power to recognize these principles from the paradoxes and the anomalies that present themselves to us in the domain of the senses, like and especially in a contradiction between two senses, like when you look at the motions of the planets, as Kepler did. He looks at the way those motions appear to our eyes and also the way they conform to certain characteristics of hearing. And from that you can develop, as he did, the harmonic principles of the characteristics of universal gravitation. A simple reflection of this way of thinking is Leibniz's argument against why you can't have perpetual motion. Why? Because he said if perpetual motion were to occur, then something irrational would be happening in the universe, something which was an effect that didn't have a cause, which was susceptible of being recognized by the human mind. And since the human mind is the creative powers of the human mind characterize the universe as a whole, that God would not allow something to happen in the universe that wasn't recognizable by the human mind. Now, and so therefore it's the principle of change and powers and potential that the human mind has to go with. Now, to make a long story short, as a result of Leibniz's discovery in dynamics, you had a huge increase. This was a thought. Leibniz had a creative discovery, a discovery of the mind, and it led to a massive material transformation in man's relationship to nature, with major advances in technology, especially the development of a heat-powered machine. And as a result of the development of the heat-powered machine, you get the need to have further scientific investigation into the nature of heat. Because prior to the development of heat-powered machine, man's use of heat was primarily just for cooking and heating spaces and so forth like that. But now with the heat-powered machine, heat becomes a form of power. So one has to try and discover what are the underlying principles of power. And heat, as opposed to gravitational power and so forth, appears in certain, as Phil says, closed systems, like in a heat-powered machine, appears to have an irreversible characteristic to it, that heat only flows in one direction, from the hot to the cold, whereas a pendulum can swing from high to low and then again up to low to high. So out of this investigation of heat, first you had actual scientific work that was done by Lazare Carnot and his son Sadi Carnot into trying to develop a maximum efficiency over the heat-powered machines. Clausius comes along. Two idiots come along. First, William Thomson. And he comes along and says, well, when you get right down to it, let's look at the universe as a whole. You see nothing but everything has a certain heat characteristic. And since heat only flows from hot to cold, then it is a characteristic of the universe for the ultimate dissipation of heat in the universe, and therefore the entire universe is going to end up in what, in a heat death, where everything stops moving. And he said, of course, don't worry about that. Don't worry about this, because some outside force will intervene to prevent that from happening. So Queen Victoria was so proud of this that she knighted him and later made him a duke, and he became known as Lord Kelvin, 1st Baron Kelvin of Largs. Now, about 10 years after Thompson put forward this idea, Clausius, doing his work on heat-powered machines, basically reworking, nothing original, writes a paper on the heat flows in a heat-powered machine, and ends the and as a recourse of this, invents the term entropy. And the term entropy comes from the Greek word tropi, which means change, and the prefix en, which means internal change. And he says that in a heat-powered machine, the only form of internal change is from hot to cold, is from a state of potential, of high potential for change, to a state of low potential for change.
And Phil, did this become a dominant view as soon as Kelvin and Clausius put it forward, or was there a fight?
No, I think there really is a fight over this, but it later becomes a dominant view. I don't think it really succeeds until into the 20th century. And the really what Lin has called, and this I think it becomes very important, this increasing reign of mathematization, this idea that you're going to get a completed axiomatic system that's going to describe the physical world. And indeed, this occurred even as we're moving beyond physics at the end of the 19th century. And Lin talks about this recently, into physical chemistry and what he says has to become biophysical chemistry, because we're more and more being able to look at, as available to us, precisely the relationship between the noetic, the biotic, the biological phenomena, and the apparently non-living.
Well, who are some of the people, I'm sorry, Phil, but who are some of the people, since personality is useful to identify how these processes function, who are some of the individuals who promoted this reign of mathematics?
Harlan, just before that, let me just finish one thing on the point is, at the end of this book, at the end of his major treatise, Clausius makes the most ridiculous statement in the world, and this is but it has become accepted. Which is, he says, the energy of the he's talking about machines, heat-powered machines. And as a result of this investigation, he says, therefore, the energy of the universe, the entire universe, is fixed. And the entropy of the universe will always increase. So he takes from a very restricted physical process and makes a bold statement about the universe as a whole, which is completely untrue. And without foundation whatsoever, and that is nothing more than what Phil's been talking about, which happens in axiomization, and so forth. That is, you state an axiom, you state something as an axiom, not whether it's true or not. You just state it like an imperial decree, and once people accept that imperial decree, then everything else falls into place according to the false belief in this.
Well, so what
axiomatic
was the
system?
What was the fight at that point then? Who was countering this and who was promoting it?
Well, Clausius was acting in reaction to the work of Gauss and Riemann in particular. Riemann had shook the world with his habilitation paper, in which he stated things that Gauss believed but was afraid to say publicly, that all axiomatic systems are the enemy of science and the enemy of mankind. And that it's the principle of change which governs society and governs science. And then Riemann proceeded to demonstrate that with his own research, physical research, into gravity, magnetism, light, heat, electricity, and so forth. And that was setting the agenda of history. And then Clausius comes in with this bogus axiomatic system, and then the fight from that point on in physics and in science becomes between those people like Planck and Einstein later, who accepted a Riemannian view, and the people who followed this axiomization approach of Clausius and all the positivists and Bertrand Russell and Hilbert and so forth.
Well, I know, Phil, you've done a lot of work on this, the positivists Russell and Hilbert. Mm-hmm. What was their particular contribution to the destruction of science and...
Well, I think the way to look at this is any axiomatic deductive formal system, whether it's Euclid or some of the later non-Euclidean idea that there's different axiomatizations, is essentially a closed, dead system. You know, in other words, everything is embodied in the axioms and the rules. And if you believe that this is, or at least we're marching toward a completed version of this, then you're accepting the idea of a non-creative, dead universe. And I think part of the way this plays is, indeed, there's a strain in the sense of identity in the idea that it's human creativity and constant development and constant exploration of the universe that also reflects the developmental aspect of the universe itself, that we will always discover more. There's always more to discover because we're opening up and creating a relationship to the universe that is constantly changing. And I think, this is what Riemann, this is what makes LaRouche the most developed, the most advanced standpoint of this historic tradition, you might call it, a tradition of non-tradition, is that he locates human identity in a rigorous sense in willful creativity, or what he calls creativity per se, which is the fact that the universe is bound by a creative developmental principle, which is reflected in human volition. Now, that's what Riemann is getting at in the habilitation paper. I think what you see is two steps in this. One is the rise of positivism, which is the idea that all you can know is what you experience and then organize into an effectively arbitrary axiomatic system. Now, this begins with the failure of the French Revolution and the victory of the American Revolution. So the École, after Napoleon is destroyed and taken over by the British, who impose an axiomatic positivistic approach, an approach which is your experience, the concatenation of experience, and the formalization of it in some axiomatic, effectively arbitrary system. The idea is, okay, this system works, so we'll live with it. Maybe that's a better approximation of the system that the universe is. Maybe we'll change it, but that's our concept. That's our epistemology. Now, I think one of the big battles that Lynn has pointed to recently, which also goes in an interesting direction, is that Riemann was a student of Dirichlet as well as Gauss. And Dirichlet was in the middle, and some of our colleagues, David Shaven, Lynn has referred to this work, Dirichlet was in the middle of a grouping of people who expressed the development of the Weimar classics, particularly in the area of music. The Mendelssohn family, Moses Mendelssohn had worked with Kästner in reviving Leibniz and Bach. These two together.
And Dirichlet now, married Dirichlet, into the Mendelssohn family.
Right. Dirichlet proposed what's been referred to as the Dirichlet principle. Effectively, as I understand it, the idea that every system is defined by its boundary, its limits, its finite limit, and the minimum or most the path of least action defined within that system. Riemann takes this and develops the idea of Riemann surfaces, which is a metaphor in mathematical language, limited, for the idea of constant increase of power and development. Now, what happens is, since this now puts mathematics at the foot of creative development and subordinates it to scientific development, because that's just an image that you now look for what in the world has this quality, and you're going to change your mathematical language to conform to that. In that way, it may be an aid, but not the idea that the arbitrary elements of the mathematics limits the world. Now, here we have Weierstrass and then his students Klein and Hilbert, though they had some of their differences. Weierstrass attacks Riemann for not being rigorous enough, i.e. not being axiomatic and deductive, and not proving that this path exists in every case. Well, indeed, Riemann and Dirichlet knew they were dealing with the real universe. So these paths existed, and that assumption was not an arbitrary assumption. So you get the this idea of mathematical axiomatic rigor. And part of what it plays on is this idea that truth is 100% certain and analytic. So truth can never develop. Truth is always fixed.
I think this is why Lynn refers to it as rigor mortis.
Well, I think this is also why the slogan of the American Revolution was live free or die. I mean, either mankind is organized according and lives freely, that is, has the free power to exercise his creativity for the development of new ideas, new forms of discovery of the way the mind works, new forms of organization of the physical universe, or we die. An axiomatic system, by its axiomatics, is a dead system. It can't change. If you change a single axiom, the whole system goes apart. And so the brainwashing that occurs with something like Clausius's absurd declaration of the second law of thermodynamics, or Euclidean geometry, which was imposed on Greek science, is that once you put things into an axiomatic or mathematic system, it will have an inevitable death because it can't change. And the only thing that the primary source of real change in the universe as a whole is the creative powers of the human mind. And the rest of the world, the living parts of the world that are, and the non-living parts, which are creative but not willful, obey. They follow the creative powers of the human mind because the creative powers of the human mind provide leadership for the universe as a whole. And man has to recognize that. When we recognize that, we live free. When we don't recognize that, we live in an imperial system, we'll die. And it really is live free or die, and we're seeing that right now played out in on the political stage. Either we get back to reestablish the American system on a level that has never been done before, or we will die.
Well, I think that the listeners can pick up on these discussions by going onto the LaRouche Pack website, where we've been posting these revolutionary articles by Lyndon LaRouche. There's another one that will probably be out before the end of this weekend, but the last one is This is a republic, not a democracy. There are probably 15 articles that have been taking up this thread. Now, we have a little more than 15 minutes left, and I'd like to bring this debate a little more up to date with the work that's come out recently, work being done in the basement that LaRouche is taking up, and that is the case of Vernadsky and Einstein and what the battles that they were having, and also this concept, again, of the nature of the universe as finite but unbounded. So, I'd like to, whichever you would like to start on the question of Vernadsky and Einstein, they do follow from this Riemannian conception, huh?
Well, yeah, let me just say a few things, and then Phil should add to it. But, you see, Planck and Einstein, you had this situation at the end of the 19th century where you had a continuation of the Riemannian approach, which was leading to all kinds of new discoveries about the nature of the physical universe. You see this especially in physical chemistry with the work of the Curies and what became at the time characterized as the sort of the relationship between the interaction between matter and radiation. And out of this, Planck and particularly and Einstein made some revolutionary discoveries that showed that the second law of thermodynamics really was not the way the universe worked, that it was actually organized so as to produce an ever-increasing potential for change. And the discovery of that created itself a higher potential for change. And new discoveries were immediately attacked by coming directly out of the British Empire, out of a movement which later became known as the Copenhagen Interpretation of Quantum Mechanics, which tried to interpret these discoveries of Planck and Einstein in a way, in a purely mathematical way, tried to reintroduce mathematics, axiomatic system, and as a result came up with the absurd conclusion that the universe is essentially random, and not only does the and that you cannot actually know what is really going on in the universe itself. One way I like to say it is that the Copenhagen interpretation said that the ontological reality is that ontological reality doesn't exist. The only thing that exists is pure mathematics. And Einstein in particular, Planck also, Planck and Einstein both were completely unyieldingly, totally stubborn in their resistance to this. But Einstein was even more irreverent than Planck. I think he was a more irreverent personality, and he also. But both of them had a great love of classical music. Planck was a pianist. Einstein was a violinist. They valued their own creativity, and they valued their commitment to seek truth, and they stubbornly opposed what has become the popular doctrine of the Copenhagen Interpretation of Quantum Mechanics. And in a certain sense, they should be most highly praised for the thing that they are the most criticized for, which is their unwillingness to go along to get along with the bullshit which tended to dominate science in the 20th century.
Well, Phil, and Lynn has brought up several times recently the role of Hilbert in this. What precisely was Hilbert's role, and how did Einstein deal with that?
Well, you know, Hilbert, at the end of the 19th century, was considered kind of the leading figure outlining a program for the axiomization of all mathematics and all of physical science. So, and, you know, he had a certain amount of talent as a mathematician. He had a certain amount of respect that the fools like Bertrand Russell, Norbert Wiener, et cetera, didn't have for the work of scientists and so on and so forth. So he set forth a program of the axiomization of all, not only of mathematics, which he believed could be complete, that mathematics could be completed and we could know the formal consistency and completeness of mathematics as a system, and that therefore that system would reign, would be the necessary way of dealing with all science.
Well, Phil, wouldn't that then go back to this problem of meaning the universe has to be a closed system?
Yeah, it absolutely would be a closed and indeed, a dead system. See, I think one important sidelight psychologically, why do people give in? Because people like to believe their freedom is arbitrary, that it's really their arbitrary anarchic will to be entertained a certain way, and they look at freedom in a limited way as tied to the individual. One of the things that Lynn goes through in the latest paper that's going to be coming out is that creativity is the ability of the human individual to grasp a universal principle of development, of historic development, and locate his or herself within that, and then communicate the ability to act from the standpoint of those principles to other human beings. So it's a way of being part of a universal process. So you have to, in a sense, subordinate your sense of freedom to being able to act on the entirety of the universe, not just expressing your own desire.
Well, that's
the oligarchy plays on that limited sense of reality.
Well, that's the now, issue of the pursuit. Let me just quickly. It's the issue of the pursuit of happiness in the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah. Now, the Einstein's view and Vernadsky very sharply was that indeed the universe is not closed in that sense. That the universe, as Einstein put it in looking at Kepler in one paper in the 1930s and then later, is he says the universe is finite, that is any set of principles reflect the limits of action in that universe, but unbounded. Because now the principles of action can be you can discover a new principle out of the limits of that universe and act on it willfully to create a new set of activity, a new ability to do work, a higher degree of power. So Einstein, I'll give you an interesting quote. Weyl, who was a student of Hilbert, who believed in this the rule of mathematics, said that tried to find ways to counter Einstein's seemingly devastating physical objections to this simple mathematical approach. Einstein, however, remained unconvinced. In one of the last letters, Weyl conjured up the image of his adversary, Einstein, throwing up his hands, reproaching him for his mathematically driven speculative approach, and exclaiming, quote, "That's not how you do physics." So, you know, this is Einstein's view. He believed in the ability to discern new principles and act on that, and yet all of human existence was lawful because this creativity is lawful. I think Einstein also is characterized by his relationship to classical music. Mozart, he made a special reference to, but Bach, Beethoven, and you can see this in Dirichlet. The real root of the most advanced scientific developments that are known to us comes from this marriage of classical composition and science, because in classical composition, you're using the creative imagination to take what went before and, in a sense, play with the idea of creating a new universe, of creating bringing a new principle of composition out of the old principles of composition. And in artistic composition, human beings have at their disposal the history of human development. That's what they're working with, the history of human creative development, the history of the ability to communicate ideas. And this is what occurs in the creative imagination. I mean, Shelley refers to this, but Lynn has made this a specific object of scientific investigation itself, of artistic development itself. It's the most self-conscious form. And I think what if you look at Vernadsky and Einstein from Lynn's standpoint, Vernadsky gives you the ability, you're looking at the interrelationship of the noetic, the biotic, and the abiotic from the standpoint of creative imagination. Physical economy becomes the most advanced area of the interrelationship of those different phases of the universe, those different principles. I mean, Lynn, apparently one thing quite provocative, because in the basement they're looking at this idea of cosmic radiation, the interrelationship of the electromagnetic, the physical, the chemical, and the biotic, and how the universe itself is full of these kinds of actions. But Lynn raised this interesting question. When we look at a cosmic ray, you know, gamma radiation, how do we know that it's abiotic? What process is it actually a part of, even as it flows through the universe, since the universe has throughout a principle of life? Might we not get manifestations of gamma radiation that are reflective of those kinds of radiation that are part of a developing living aspect of the universe? So these are the kinds of things we're looking at in the interrelationship of the abiotic, the biotic, and the noetic, and ultimately the creative.
And Bruce, we have a few minutes. If you would like to just add something to that.
Well, I think this is the crucial point that people really have to come to grips with, because people might in general, in the popular culture today, and even among scientific cultures, might think that I'll acknowledge that the human mind is capable of making what appears to it to be a creative discovery, the discovery of a new musical composition or poem, or even the discovery of a new scientific theory. But that this is just something that happens in the human mind, and the universe itself is actually just chugging along randomly and dissipating heat and tending towards in an entropic way. But that falls, once you buy into that, then you've been poisoned to destroy the powers of the human mind. That it's, as Lynn has emphasized, it's really the other way around. The universe is creative. There's only one universe. There may be three different characteristic processes which we associate with non-living, living, and human cognition, but they exist interacting everywhere in the universe as a single process for creative development, in which the creative powers of the human mind, being the only willful form of creativity that we know of in the universe, is what's actually leading things. And therefore, we have to organize everything in our society, in our personal lives, in our view of life and non-life and physics and science and art from that standpoint. And if we recognize that as the fundamental principle, then you fight passionately for the organization of society based on those principles, and the highest form developed is the Constitutional Republic of the United States. And you have to make that the form of organization, or fight for the right for people to find in their own way to organize society in that way. And mankind then has a very bright future, and the universe has a very bright future with the extension of human creativity in this form beyond the Earth into the solar system and deep into the universe beyond.
Well, I think it's clear we can conclude that unless we have this kind of axiomatically revolutionary outlook of LaRouche brought in as the dominant idea that shapes economic policy as well as science, we may not have a human race. In fact, they may be right. They may have created a dead system.
Well, the advantage is live free or die. Right now, people are confronted with the reality that this culture will die if it doesn't live freely.
I think part of what LaRouche is getting at is we have to get the population to recognize the universal process that's unfolding in front of them. And they're going to have to cross the boundary into a future. From the standpoint of these guys, there is no future. From the standpoint of an axiomatic system, there is no future. So Lynn's point is humanity has a future, but people have to go outside of the system they've come to believe in, free market, all this stuff. Most of what we call economic theory is nothing but this form of positivism or radical Benthamite fascism. And Lynn's saying there is a future, but you have to get into that future to see the changes that we can make in the present. You know, I'm struck by the fact that we don't have time. There's so many things to say. Bruce referred to this Born, Heisenberg, Copenhagen. I mean, I'll say two things. One is these guys were bent on the idea that we can't know the real universe, that all we can do is deal with the arbitrary mathematics that may seem to work, but we don't know its relationship to the truth in fact. And Heisenberg said, I'm dealing with a closed system. Now, I'll tell you something about Hilbert. Hilbert believed that Göttingen should be the center of all this, the center of mathematics, the mathematizing of science. And once the Nazis rose to power, for the last 10 years of his life, he was so demoralized, he did nothing. So I think that tells you something compared to Einstein, who saw himself, of course, as battling this fascism, or Vernadsky, who, as a national figure in Russia, aided Russia in defeating fascism. Hilbert was so demoralized he did nothing for 10 years.
You know, this is an obvious point that there's so much more we could discuss. I wanted to bring up something I found, an old article recently from Mr. LaRouche called The Floristan Principle, about the question of the arts, the classical tradition of Beethoven, how in fact it's this classical tradition which, to the extent that it's available to people, reduces the neurotic distortions in people's thinking. And clearly, when you destroy classical culture, you allow for the rapid expansion of neuroses. And I think that's one of the ways you can explain a President Bush followed by a President Obama. But we're obviously going to have to do this again. I think We can summarize this by saying people go to the website, take a look at the latest papers by Lyndon LaRouche, get into these discussions, find your local LIM member, bring it up with them. If you're young enough, you can join a Monge Brigade and take it up as a full-time activity. And most importantly, practice this in your day-to-day life by becoming a LaRouche PAC member and supporting our candidates. We're out of time. Phil and Bruce, thanks a lot. We'll be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time for the LaRouche Show.